This is Edwin K. Morris, and you are about to embark on the next Pioneer Knowledge Services Because You Need to Know, a digital resource for you to listen to folks share their experience and knowledge around the field of knowledge management and nonprofit work. If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email bynTK at pioneer-ks.org.
Hi all, my name is Moriah. So I live in Israel. I live in the countryside, somewhere between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And it's really funny because the way they designed this city is taking a map, checking the difference between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and cutting it to half and putting their city. And one of the things that people don't know about me is that not only I love knowledge management and I love knowledge management, I also love my 6 grandchildren, which is not surprising that I love them, but somehow I make people being surprised that I have 6 grandchildren. I love my flowers very much. I have flowers in my garden. I have a big garden. I have flowers near the windows. I have over 20 orchids. And I always have flowers in all kinds of vases that my husband buys me every week again and again. And it's so easy to buy me flowers. I can say that this May, I'm celebrating 25 years of doing KM. 25 years ago, I switched my occupation. Before, I was an IT person. And the truth is, I never liked it. I've chosen it by coincidence for a few years, trying to find my specific field and what I like. And the day I was exposed to the idea of knowledge management, it took me 2-3 days to fall in love. And since then, I live, breathe, almost eat and sleep knowledge management. I've built this large knowledge base, KM ROM, KM like knowledge management, and ROM like ROM. .com. So I'm all the time looking how to put in all the things I like and find excuses for doing them also on hours and times that I'm not supposed to work.
When we talk knowledge, specifically knowledge in an organization, what do you find is the biggest challenge to using and reusing an organization's knowledge?
The truth is that giving one answer only will never fit. Let's give, for example, engineers. Engineers, there's a syndrome named NIH, not invented here. They, of course, speak in the importance of reusing knowledge. However, when it comes to a specific case, a lot of them will say, oh, yeah, that's nice, but in this case, we have to develop something new. So even if they have knowledge, they not too often use it. But when I go to other populations to other archetypes, we will find that one of the big problems is that we count so much on our experts that we feel very confident them being here, even though there's a very big risk that if tomorrow they're not here, their knowledge is gone and the organization has a very serious business continuity problem. I think that's one of the main problems that people speak about, but not enough because they don't find the right answer how to do it. Maybe that's one of the reasons they say, okay, and they go on.
The continuity piece, somebody has to own that function, right? The problem is that people rely on their own behaviors of how they communicate and how they share or they don't share. But if the organization has built a structure that says, this is how things will work here, so like in your case, instead of reinventing something or wasting resources going down a trail that's already been gone down previously, if the organization is not smart enough, and I mean smart in the sense that their data and information is readily used, there's no purposeful function for somebody in an organization to look through everything historically first in the organization to understand what has gone on before that could relate or may relate or be the answer of the current question. So is the behavior somebody's responsibility to ensure it happens?
Oh, I think that could be an easy one. Because if every manager will understand that the way as he is in charge He has a title, finance officer, chief finance officer, or chief engineering officer, whatever. If he's a manager, he A, has a title. B, he's in charge of the business that has to relate to this topic. And C, he or she are in charge of the people that are dealing with it. Mm-hmm. So if we add them part four, part D, and say, yes, and they are also in charge of the knowledge and information of that discipline, that's a very important component of the solution. Yet, I think that someone in the organization, and it can be one of several functions, HR, knowledge management, strategy, someone has to be in charge of the methodology, of the routines, of the infrastructure enabling it. But the direct responsibility should be of the manager, and it should be part of maybe even every job description or job role.
Mm-hmm. I like the sounds of that, because I think that's the best application of trying to get everybody playing by the same structure equally. What would be the solution you would approach starting that? So if our listeners are like, boy, I wish we could get there, I wish we could do that, what would be your suggestion to them to start with first?
Okay. I like your question, pointing where to start, because I saw several organizations starting, and I think they're starting at the wrong place. Because the two typical solutions I found, one of them is saying, let's instruct every employee to document all his knowledge at the end of the day, at the end of the job, at the end of the task. Yes, I'm happy you're laughing at work. It's so unrealistic, and I found it in so many books.
Explain to us why that is so unrealistic, please.
Yes, let's remember that we really love ourselves and we really love knowledge management, but knowledge management is means and not an objective. And if there's a salesperson, we want him more to sell than to document how he did it. And if he has 3 sales to close, it takes time to documenting his best practices. Not even easy, because capturing them isn't easy, because part of them are tacit and part of them explicit. And he's a salesperson, he's not a KM person. So what do we want out of him? Mm-hmm. It's very ideal, but not realistic. So that's one bad way that people, that organizations try to start with it. Another way is saying, oh, we are well organized. Let's map our organization, check all the roles, check all the people, see how many we have from these and from these and from this, and what are the competencies. And then after a year, we will have a fantastic map and we will know where to start. And you're not yet laughing, but I want to explain to you that this idea is unrealistic also. Because what happens too many times, or I say even in the majority of the cases, we spend a full year in deciding where we need our knowledge retention. However, if I take you to any manager, to every C-suite, and ask him, you have 20 people here, please point me to the 2 or 1 experts. You do it in a minute with no amount to know that. So what do? We lose a year, we lose energy, we lose money, we get 0 knowledge management, and organizations kick those who did it out. Or they bury the report and no one starts knowledge retention. So first of all, I'm trying to explain why the typical solutions that I found that are spoken more than any other ways are unrealistic and won't do. And we have to think like we know how to think out of the box. We have to start not from A to Z, but start maybe from C.
So the first example was like the vision. This is what we would like, you know, the everybody just share and document their knowledge. That's what we would like. That's the big umbrella. The second case was they wanted to overanalyze and spend all this time and resource, and it was too heavy of a lift for something that could have been started without a year's worth of investment. The in-between is kind of the target. If you can find some actionable construct that you can put some juice behind, that's your best approach.
Yes, but the reason I gave you the two previous approaches are because these are the most popular ones according to the literature that we meet in knowledge management literature.
Okay.
I didn't start with giving crazy approaches because they're crazy. The most popular approaches are the two I mentioned. I want to suggest something different.
Okay.
So let's speak first of all about its principles, because the principles should be that it is an efficient methodology, very efficient, very effective. Why efficient? Because the time of our experts or those who are leaving, maybe, that knocked on the door and said, we are leaving, or we know that they're leaving because they're retiring or for any other reason, we never have enough time of their time. And those who we want to retain their knowledge the most are probably the most busy people in the organization. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if every KM effort should be efficient, this should be super efficient. But we can't have life too simple. We have to have it also very effective, because the most easy thing is saying, okay, let's do it efficient. Well, I heard something about the Volkswagen way, which is very popular in the German countries, German-speaking countries. Because really, Volkswagen is a great organization. At least what I heard is that they have 4 hours, let's speak with the one who's leaving, 4 hours with the one who's coming in, and 4 hours coaching. That's nice. If that is the case, that's very shallow. Not because it's Volkswagen. Volkswagen is a wonderful organization with a KM, very good staff. So I'm trying to suggest something that should be, one principle is efficient, but the second principle is deep. And I want to go to our friend Polanyi, because Polanyi taught us all that the tacit knowledge is the most important knowledge in the organization. And these experts, it's not what's written on the walls. Mm-hmm. It's their tacit knowledge that's very hard, yet you have to dig in and in, that we need. So we need it to be deep, effective, mm-hmm. and fast, efficient. So I hope I made you even more curious before I tell you how explaining the principles.
The interesting piece is that I've seen similar frameworks where it's very shallow in the transition and almost childlike. You know, usually there's like a out processing interview that might last an hour or 2 hours. I mean, it's, or some kind of way they make an effort to collect what they can. But it is such ill use of resources, because you're not going to capture anything really useful at that point, because that person's got one leg out the door. All the opportunities to grab stuff that would have made a difference was during the course of their tenure, the course of the time they were there, not when they're getting ready to step out. I like the idea of the bridge. When you said about the 4 hours on either side, and then there is a benefit to having a one-to-one relationship bridge. Most organizations don't have that opportunity, because somebody will exit and it takes 6 months to fill the seat. And so that bridge never happens, because it just doesn't, it's very hard to make that happen because of the in and out of it. But I would very much like to dig into how you see this and the principles making this better.
Great. So first of all, I'll go step by step.
Okay.
I'm working on this methodology over a decade, and I've even packaged it, and I call it, and I like the naming that you call it, spoke about bridging, mm-hmm. because we speak about bridging the old generation with the new generation, and we call it key sure. So key sure, you can say it's, oh, we need a key in order to be sure that the knowledge really goes from the old generation to the new generation. I may say some gaming with the words, because when we speak about kishur, we actually took a Hebrew word, kishur, meaning connection. Mm. So we are speaking about exactly about the bridge, the connection between the past and the future. Mm-hmm. So how is it done? Because I'm giving you too many hints and I'm not giving you the answers. And I'm sure that our listeners want to say, okay, cut the bullshit and start examining. So I'll go and I say that we have 3 stages. The first stage would be to map the topics that are really rare, that are really unique, undocumented, and important for the organization in the future, and to prioritize these and only choose what is going to be captured and whatnot. Because too many times, if you think about it like a bell distribution, people go, if you give someone a chance to speak or to write, or you interview him, they go to the middle. They go to the high top. This knowledge, this information, is already documented or is in the walls, in the computer systems, in the forms. Everyone knows that. The most important knowledge are on the extremes. Yeah. So remember that. So I'm giving you both the first stage, map the unique ideas and prioritize them. I'm not giving here all the sub-methodology because we have a short time, but I'm giving the big stage. And I'm giving you a very, very good tip. Look for the extremes. Look for those things that not already we know and seem so essential. The essential things we know. We want to know how you fix problems. We want to know how to tackle some untypical situations, etc. So that was stage one. I'll give you stage two and a tip also to stage two. Stage two would be, and that sounds easy, document the knowledge. Take 40, 60, 80 hours. It's not really sitting 80 hours with the expert because half of the time at least is back office. And document the knowledge. However, only the knowledge that was prioritized. Take or in your KM work or in your HR work for encouraging people to share also tacit knowledge and not only explicit, easy to share knowledge. However, the big tip I want to add here is structure it twice. Structure the process because it's so easy to start and to lose yourself in it and say, and the second one is to structure the output. The two tips is structure the process and structure the output. Now I'll answer your question. I'm sorry.
Structure the process.
And structure the outputs that you document. Don't make it a story.
I like the way you're presenting on the bell curve kind of concept that the important things are out here on the edge, not in the main bucket, because that's a main common knowledge, if you will. The uncommon knowledge is the things on the sides that we really want to look at. And in doing that, we're wanting to codify that fray stuff and make it available, make it seeable, findable, searchable, usable, and extract and pull that knowledge out of somebody. But you're saying in that step, not only are we structuring the process, how do we get it, to how do we use it? What is the output? What do we want to do with it, right? That's what you're getting to.
I have yet stage number three. Stage number two, I am structuring the process to make sure that at the end of this effort, I have the most important knowledge and not knowledge that I didn't want to speak about or I didn't get the most important part. Because there's always endless knowledge, even if I prioritize some topics only. So the structuring and being very micromanagement, very, very aware, monitoring the time and monitoring the efforts and monitoring what is said and how the time is spent is very important for success. Sure. Now I go to step number three. And Edwin, I love you. I think that I'll take you with me to these topics because you understand the essence. Step number three has to do with delivery, as you say, because too many times you can come up, even if somebody, that's why I said not write it as a story. You can come up with these pages, one after the other, and it's not even on pages. It's on the computer. Yes, in several organizations, we found it only on a notebook. Now we're in a better place. We have it documented, something that is in the computer. And even if the organization is very happy, it's buried down there. Mm-hmm. Step number three is critical. It's not only we are structuring the output so it will be easy to using it, because it's not a long story like a video that is 3 hours, 5 hours, and no one really can grab it, because we need today to grab something concrete, use, and go back. We also ask third, the delivery process, how do we embed this knowledge or this information, because we already captured it, documented, structured it, so it's already turned to be information. How do we embed it in the organizational environment, making it closer to those who need it tomorrow, close to the forms, close to the computing systems, close to the decision-making processes, etc. Step A, map and prioritize. Step B, document, but do it wisely. Stage three, deliver in easy-to-access way, very close, embedding it in the organizational environment, in its routines, in its IT systems, and in other places where it will be easy to just hand, go and take it very easily.
I see where it would be an awesome piece to have a I'm going back to library systems. I mean, if you had a curator that was able to work with the IT structure and the enterprise, whatever the enterprise is using, in order to one, are you familiar with the term instructional designer?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm hearing is, and I'm going to transform this into a different language set, but what it sounds like is if you had similar to an instructional designer, which can take large content and depending on the learning objectives, be able to scale all that content down to the essence of what the learner needs to have. So in your step three, when you're talking about setting up proper consumption of this new knowledge or this now codified knowledge, it's almost the similar path of a learner having properly constructed learning materials like an instructional design where you can boil things down to the essence of what's important. Does this require, and I guess the question therein, does this process require a curator, somebody that's in charge of the flow, of the continuity flow of all the knowledge, all the data and information? I won't say knowledge, but...
I think it's unrealistic to have such a curator. Mm. Yes, I do agree with you that at the end of the day, learning, training, knowledge management, probably within some time, they will blend into one. Because learning speaks about peak events and knowledge speaks about ongoing events. So it's more even challenging to design the knowledge for ongoing use and not for specific peak events. It's the same type of need. And I think that no matter if these three stages, we do them, and I train more and more people in my company and within partners to do it also. It's not rocket science. It's something that can be taught. This Kishur methodology. What I'm saying is that I believe in many organizations, it can be HR, it can be training, it can be KM, it can be many functions that help the organization find their way to do it for the experts, for those who have special knowledge. Because for the regular people, I would use some interview because everyone has something, but something very slim, very, I wouldn't only interview it, I would structure it and have the we have in mind how to do it. We do it also for regular people very easily, you know. But for the special people, take a specialist. You don't have to be go to university and learn psychology. But there are special cases, like within the 5% of the experts, where you need the psychology. The same way you need a psychologist for the 5% of the children, that way for the 5% of the employees, those who are experts, use one of the functions that understands learning, understands knowledge capturing, understands documenting, and understands accessibility.
So this overall should just be a business function. This is not necessarily a KM responsibility. This should be a business operational function taught in a business school.
I think that KM should be in 20 years taught in business school only, or 20, 40 years. I don't know when. Maybe it will lucky 7 years, but that is the vision, but we're not yet there. So meantime, we are using KM or near function.
Can you give me a good example of this implementation of Kishur?
Of course. And I want to add several vices, because if you do it once, twice, 20, 50, 250 times, you can structuring. So we have templates and we have best practices. And now we came to this engineer who finished building a large plant. We tried understanding what is his unique knowledge. And he said this and this and this and this and this and this and this, 67 topics. So no, stop. No time for 67 topics. Let's find the six most important. And I'll give you one example, because he said the most important knowledge is how to choose this type of machines. And we looked at him and he said, really? Yes, really. It's very knowledgeable. And we asked him, because we have the question. We're not that smart, but we have the questions because we have the methodology in our pockets, and he's a very important engineer. And we asked him very nicely and very frankly, yes, and when next time will we choose again new machines for the plant? Next year, no. The year after, no. 3 years later, we will buy new versions. So when will we choose new machines? He thought, and he said, a decade from now. Okay, a decade from now, the technology would be so different. We said, we think that maybe it is very important knowledge that you have, but maybe it's less important for the knowledge retention project. So this is just one more a small example how with the right questions, you can map and prioritize the right things to document or not to document.
So you did an evaluation of shelf life. What's the shelf life reoccurrence? You know, how is this going to show up in the next time to add weight or take weight from what that knowledge set is? And it's a great example because, as you just said, in 10 years' time, you know, you could throw this whole thing out and start over because it's going to be a different ball game. So how valuable is it? You know, and so I like the idea of putting a timeline to the value. Because if you look out 10 years, you're right. It's like, yeah, well, we shouldn't spend a whole lot of time on this one.
Oh, that's because we don't need that in knowledge probably for the coming 10 years. But I'll go one step further with you because I like you are conceptualizing the example. I'll share with you that actually we have three things I want on our list when we are checking if it's valuable or not.
Okay.
We ask ourselves, what is the level of uniqueness of this topic? If we look around us, do we find other people with it in the organization, in the division, in other organizations? Mm. Can we buy it? So that's one question. Second question will be as to the level of documentation. It's not only if this knowledge is unique, was it already documented? Where, how, in computing system, in business rules, nowhere. And the third level question, regards to what you were saying, has to do with the importance of it to the organization tomorrow. And I'll give you one tip. In order to understand this question, we ask other people to evaluate it, not the expert. The expert is always subjective. He loves his knowledge. And that's why if you let someone speak, they start speaking about what they love and what they admire and what they did. I admire Daniel Kahneman. Going back to here, the beginning. We ask the colleagues who consume his knowledge. We ask the manager of the unit to sign and to agree to the prioritized issues, because the one that has to stay in charge after that expert leaves is the manager. So he has a better way, even if he doesn't understand all the details, and the colleagues surrounding the expert have a better chance of evaluating, of helping us evaluate the importance of it for the future.
You're really throwing this against the organizational wall to see what the importance is, because you're right. You can have a lot of self-importance put upon something because it's theirs, maybe not really tied to the complete picture of what the organization is heading in 5 to 10 years strategically. So there's got to be a balance between that, right? So, and that's a beautiful way to put it, because I think a lot of folks in this kind of framework, when you're going to get that info or that data from the subject matter expert, it's easy to get kind of fallen into that bucket of, wow, this is really important. It may be to that individual. It may be to that section or department. But when you look in the overall scope of the whole organization, then you got to weigh it there too.
Yes, because maybe there's a technology that's coming by and we'll replace it. We had that deal with someone who was a mechanical expert for airplanes, for an airplane that was aging out. I have so many, I said 250 projects, so many examples, I don't want to tire you out, of people who really love what they do, and it's a good sign, but it's not a good sign if you want them to evaluate the knowledge retention project.
What would be your level of awareness to a listener? What would be your indication that they should be looking around in their own organization? What are key things that are highlighting lack of retention or knowledge loss in an organization?
I want to add one thing before. I want to tell you that comparing to other projects, it's an easy decision for the manager. And you may ask why. What makes it very easy to decide on such a project is that you can slice and dice. You don't have to take a big decision going in on knowledge retention for the whole organization. You can pilot it. You can say, okay, I'm not interested in all the organization. I have a problem here and now. And the managers don't sleep at night when they know that someone's leaving and he's an expert. Let's see if it works. Mm-hmm. If it works, it will sell itself and I will buy another one and another one, another one. But that way, the decision is small. So you don't have to evaluate the decision if to start knowledge retention, if to educate yourself, if to take a consultant. So I think that's a very important piece, because if you, let's say, decide of building a portal or having some other knowledge management, building audio room, it's a lot of money to put into, to invest. For such a decision, it can be sliced. It can be very specific for one small project. It works good. Okay, another part. Didn't work good? Let's go to back old ways that we were used to. Now I want to ask you, you're asking where to have knowledge. Please repeat your question and I'll try answering directly.
So what I'm thinking is that what would the average listener be looking for in their organization as indications of knowledge loss, where there's not good retention or continuity anywhere? What are some examples of what they would see as an issue?
You can see several things. Because when business performance degrades, starts going worse when we don't know the answers, when we have to, it takes us more time to fix problems, when it takes us more time to develop new products, new software, new hardware, to design new machinery, we understand that something's going wrong. And if it happens after someone that was an expert leaves, it's easy to see. It's very easy to see. The idea is to do it before. Not we already lose the knowledge in assets. Did we lose knowledge? Yes, we did, because it affects business performance almost immediately. The next time I have a problem, the next time I have a project and I don't have the right person to put, I feel it. It's not like magic. All his brains move from here to there. It's not that someone is the expert, but we are leveraging it. We are leveraging their abilities. And if it comes on a good infrastructure, we're doing something that wouldn't happen naturally. Would take many years until the new incomers, the new generation, would get to this level. It's a crazy world that's changing all the time, and the competition is so harsh. So you can look around yourself and see all over you a knowledge retention problem. Don't wait. Yeah. Look around and ask, who do I go to, someone specific every time after time when I don't find an answer? Mm. So don't wait until he leaves. Document his knowledge now, his unique knowledge, his important knowledge. And you can start using it and going to him only on the more important questions, on the more unique things.
I want to talk about that because I don't want the listener to think that you're only trying to target experts. I think you're using subject matter expert or expert as just an example. But I want folks to come away with, it doesn't matter on a job title. It doesn't matter on your level of experience and expertise. To the organization, you can have critical knowledge that may be undocumented and out there on the sides, but you're not in a position of command, or you're not a vice president, you're just a regular person. That critical knowledge, that knowledge that you speak of that is a resource for the organization, to value it as continuity, can be anybody. That can be from anyone in your, even outside the organization. So don't think that you have to only target subject matter experts. So I have an example. This is a different way I'm looking at the continuity. So I know of a large nonprofit here in the States that had spent a fair amount of money developing a report via a third party, a consultant to come in and provide data and analysis of a certain thing. It was not until that money was spent, they got the report, that somebody found a similar report that was paid for and done 10 years prior. That was then dug up, and it was uncanny that nothing had really changed in a decade. That analysis from a different outfit from the initial one 10 years prior had very similar data, had very similar outcomes and observations and analysis and recommendations. To me, what I find is a total waste of resources and specific time and money to an organization is when they don't look in their own data first to build a trend, to build an analysis, to build an understanding on a comprehensive level. There's not enough built-in behaviors that says, before we spend dollars on this, what have we done in the past? There seems to be a lack of commitment to understand previous knowledge that has already been pulled into the organization. How do you address that in the big world of continuity of your knowledge resource?
First of all, to your first comment, very important. Yes, it's easy for me to speak about experts, they are so easy to spot. But yes, we're speaking about the critical knowledge where some experts may have more and some other employees may have less, but they all have it. As to your second question, one way that we use in Kishoo is, first of all, to help the organization by structuring the knowledge so it will be easy to consume, embedding the knowledge very closely to the user so it will be easy to grab and consume. However, participate in a change here, because if ChatGPT will be as promising as it looks, maybe we will use it, search for the information much more, knowing that every time we search, we use this within the organization, the data organization, but they're already promising us, and we will find it even if we didn't organize it correctly in the best way. Of course, it's better to embed it. It's better to first structure it. It's better to help the machine help us. But in the meantime, we'll do that. In the coming future, the machine will even help us more. I believe that this situation where we have so much knowledge and information documented and codified knowledge that are unused will actually change, and we are on a good track. And you and I are a very fascinating timing working where we are seeing our occupation and our job description changing, not within a long 5-10 years, within months or even less.
So what you're talking about with the AI assist is that, in my mind, it will become the digital curator of your organization in order to help bring and make more available comprehensive knowledge, not just a keyword search that you then got to spend a half an hour trying to read whatever that word was, wherever you searched, and going through all that content, but you can get summaries. So it becomes a business intelligence tool that saves time and adds value within the constraints of the organization's knowledge set, which is awesome. And I think you're right. It will transform how things are done. It'll make things easier than the old ontology, taxonomy, construction of all this metadata and all the things that we are used to seeing in an organization or trying to get to in an organization. We're going to kind of skip a step. We're going to kind of skip a lot of that, I think, because it won't be as necessary with this type of interface now, and you'll be able to get to fast action data and results to make better decisions. Absolutely.
Yes. But however, because we don't have that big data within the organization, we still have to help it. And the same way Google that was embedded inside organizations was not as good as Google that came from the internet with the endless amounts of content. Mm. Therefore, this business assistant work will operate less good within organizations. So yet I would not delete the third stage of good delivery, of embedding the knowledge, of structuring it. I would leave it, but the combination, and I love that we call the AI augmentation. Together, business AI assistant, KM expert, we'll do it. And now I think it's the organization's time to say, okay, like we say in Nike, just do it. Start retaining, start documenting your knowledge. And maybe if we know that there's these machines and these people who help us turn it be so usable, we will actually start documenting much more. Experts, SMEs, critical knowledge all over the place using Kishoo and several different endless methodologies, all good, all existing. I only demonstrated today one of them. And I'm calling anyone who's interested in hearing more details and explain so they can do it by themselves. But there's endless other ideas that can help.
I want to bring up, just had a recent conversation with Nick Milton. He's been just on the show. And we talked about the ISO 30401, the knowledge management systems requirements. And he brought up something that I did not realize, because we've talked a lot today of the tacit and express knowledge, things that are the different types of knowledge. And he said in that ISO, they purposely did not use the word tacit knowledge. They only refer to the two types of knowledge as documented and undocumented. His description was tacit ends up being a little gray area, but if you just say undocumented, then that means it's somewhere other than documented. So I like that framework. And everything you're talking about, if we get to the point where we've got an AI KM guru that's going to help your organization internally, it still has to be documented. they can't access brains yet. So maybe that'll be coming. Maybe we can just plug in an USB to the back of my cranium and boom, I don't have to document anything. You'll just suck it out of my head. The documentation is the key ingredient to any of this.
Yes. Nick was on my team when we worked on the IVA 3041. One afternoon, sitting in the building, Dick and myself, we sat together and tried defining all these terms. And there was a very big debate between Mike Wagner from Germany and from different people asking, what are the terms? Do we speak about tacit and implicit and explicit, documented, codified? Nick and I took the responsibility to write Annex B, that you can find at 3041, that speaks about the different states of knowledge, the spectrum of the knowledge, and the transitions. And every time you have this transition of knowledge, if it's valuable, that's knowledge management. Now, when I refer to tacit knowledge today, I refer to the family, not exactly only to the tacit, to knowledge that you're unaware of. To the general purpose, speaking about tacit knowledge, implicit knowledge, undocumented knowledge, unstructured knowledge, unfound knowledge, etc. The tacit is what is like the diamonds, what sparkles out. And as Nick and I wrote in Annex B on 3041, all transitions are important and the spectrum is important and we need it all. So we have already what's shared and codified and structured, and we need the others as well.
So everybody understands on the listener side, the Cambridge Dictionary defines tacit knowledge as knowledge that you do not get from being taught or from books, but get from personal experience, for example, when working in a particular organization. It's that I'm getting a shaky finger. What? That's not it?
I think that we in knowledge management define tacit knowledge differently. Tacit, we want to be very precise. Tacit is the knowledge we are unaware of. Implicit is what we are maybe aware of, but find it hard to express in words. And that's the tacit that really, I don't know why I play the piano so good or why I know how to fix problems. Implicit is what I know, but it's hard for me to explain to you. I can show you maybe. And then we start externalizing it or codifying it or sharing it. And sometimes we can even share it without turning it from tacit to explicit or from implicit to explicit, as Nonaka has taught us, because Nonaka taught us start with socialization. Start with speaking with someone else on the tacit knowledge. How can you speak about tacit knowledge if you don't know how to express it? Use a metaphor.
Do you feel the tacit knowledge in the framework of knowledge management is more on the intuition side? It's more intuitive for somebody?
Yes.
That level of knowledge, that intuition.
Exactly.
I don't know why I know this, but that's my gut feeling. I'm telling you, don't do that.
Yes. I'll say, on the other hand, when we say tacit many times, like I did in the beginning of discussion here, I wasn't precise. I wasn't precise on the definition because we usually use it for saying all the uncodified, all the undocumented knowledge, as you said. However, that's the definition. It's only the intuition part, one that I'm unaware of. But it doesn't really matter. Because if we go to practical level, as you said, and as I said, that you're a wise person, go for the undocumented knowledge, find the important pieces that help you run your organization also tomorrow and handle them.
Well, as long as we're on definitions, what is your magic definition of knowledge management? Everybody loves that question. Everybody just loves that question.
So I'll tell you, I had several definitions on the way because it's not really a good one. I loved it when, I think that was over 10 years ago, 42 definitions of knowledge management and still counting. Mm-hmm. But however, I can't just blab about it. I have to give you an answer, right? That knowledge management is a systematic, methodology-based set of activities and approaches to safeguard and to leverage the performance or competence based on its knowledge. So let's look at it. You know, when you speak about strategy, you speak about the why, the who, the what, and the how. The why is to leverage, to safeguard the organization's performance or to leverage its competence and its abilities. The who are the stakeholders of the organization. The how is systematic methodology-based activities. That's why it's knowledge management, why it's managed. And the what is typically including activities of acquiring, applying, and retaining knowledge. And of course, developing new one.
You know, you brought up the point where there was many different definitions of knowledge management, But really, there's really just an overall essence in most definitions that is common. I pulled up in the ISO for knowledge management, 30401, the simplest definition I've ever seen for knowledge management, which is management with regard to knowledge.
That's a very, I may say, I was the leader of the ISO 3041 document. I had a bunch of 20 experts in the room. And if I would let them argue on it, I knew I'd never end it. Yeah. So that was what happened on step one.
Yeah.
ISO 3041, 3 years later, it started at 2018. On 2021, we had an amendment with new definitions and including a different definition of knowledge management, because we understood definition has to add value to those who read it. Therefore, the updated definition is knowledge management is holistic, cross-functional discipline and set of practices focused on knowledge that improve the organization performance. It includes but is not limited to creation, acquisition, application, maintenance, sharing, and protection of knowledge to create organizational value. And that definition is really reasonable. The first definition was a good way to end the project because otherwise it would never end.
You bring us to the conclusion of our discussion with the idea that the knowledge and its management is a very detailed function of an organization. You don't necessarily have to have a chief knowledge officer. You may not even have a knowledge management function or a directorate or however your organization is. But the responsibility, in my view, is a leadership responsibility because you're managing a resource. This is an asset and it should be addressed as such. And if your organization is not putting any pressure on that asset of its own knowledge, you're missing the boat.
I love the use of the three terms, resource, asset, and value. We have to take these resources, find the value, and help the organization use it as an asset.
Like a superhero.
Back to square one.
Back to square one. Thank you. Absolute joy having you again on the show.
Thank you so much. And now I understand how you enjoy your day every time again and again, because someone sits with you, speaks, and you have a good time every day.
It's that easy. It is that easy. If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email bynTK@pioneer-ks.org. You have just finished our latest Because You Need to Know, a public service of Pioneer Knowledge Services. Please join us on LinkedIn and find us at pioneer-ks.org.